It's April the 2nd, 2026, and you're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman, in Flagstaff, bringing you news from our military news websites and the Veterans Administration, as well as our Veterans Service Organizations websites and publications. Well, let's start with Stripes.com, the official website of the Stars and Stripes newspaper, for this item from the 31st of March by Matthew Adams. Military suicides decrease in 2024 from previous year, Pentagon says. The suicide rate among active duty troops decreased in 2024 from the previous year, according to the annual report released Tuesday by the Pentagon. However, the active component rate has increased since 2011. It remains to be seen whether the short-term decreases observed in 2024 in the active component will signal a change in long-term trends, the 78-page report says. For years, the Pentagon has struggled to bring down the number of suicides in the ranks. The Defense Department began collecting and reporting quarterly surveillance data on service member suicides in 2018, to help guide prevention efforts. Overall, there were 471 reported suicides across the total force in 2024. The most recent year the statistics have been recorded, compared with 531 in 2023. The Air Force, Navy, Army, Marine Corps, and Reserves all saw decreases, but the National Guard rate increased by about 13%, according to the report. The rate is calculated based on an active duty force of about 1.33 million troops and about 770,000 Reserve and National Guard personnel combined. The Defense Department in recent years has aimed to improve mental health care access for troops amid increases in suicide rates and an outcry from Congress and others. In 2022, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin approved the establishment of the Suicide Prevention and Response Independent Review Committee, which made 127 recommendations of near and long-term solutions to address suicides in the ranks. The Pentagon selected 83 of the recommendations from the committee. The independent panel recommended the department implement a series of gun safety measures to reduce suicides in the force, including waiting periods for the purchase of firearms and ammunition by service members on military property. The panel said the department should also raise the minimum age to 25 for service members to buy guns and ammunition, and should require anyone living in military housing to register privately owned firearms. In addition, the panel said the department should restrict the possession and storage of privately owned firearms in military barracks and dormitories. Austin released a memo September 2023 outlining more than 100 recommendations to be implemented by 2030 to address the suicide crisis in the military. Some of the recommendations included expanding telehealth services, increasing appointment availability by revising the mental health staff model, launching a comprehensive public education campaign on firearm safety, and updating the amount of suicide prevention training. The department chose not to implement the firearm changes at the time. Consistent with previous years, firearms were the leading method of death by suicide across the force. Most firearm deaths occurred with a personally owned firearm, according to the report. The Pentagon is developing a secure storage voucher program to be piloted at select locations and creating a multimedia education campaign on secure firearm storage, the report states. It did not provide further details. As of November, the Pentagon has implemented 27 of 83 recommendations, according to the report. The 2024 suicide report also included data about military family suicides. The number of suicides reported was the same as 2023. The National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available by calling or texting 988. There's also an online chat at 988 988lifeline.org. That's one word, 988lifeline.org. That's military suicides decrease in 2014 from previous year, Pentagon says. Next, we have Watchdog finds staff turnover, vacancies affect housing voucher program for homeless veterans. This is by Linda Hershey of Stars and Stripes from the 30th of March, Washington. The Department of Veterans Affairs has had challenges to hiring and retaining enough case managers to provide counseling and support to veterans in a specialized housing voucher program that targets homelessness, according to a report from the Government Accountability Office. A GAO analysis showed that the annual case manager turnover rate ranged from 20 to 26% between fiscal years 2020 and 2024. The effects of insufficient staffing include reduced services for veterans and delays in admitting new participants, according to the report titled Veteran Homelessness Programs: Opportunities to Improve Data Collection and Establish an Evaluation Plan. GAO investigators said that stakeholders interviewed at 8 VA sites described periods of high turnover and persistent vacancies, according to the report published Monday. The Housing Voucher Program is a collaboration between the VA and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Veterans experiencing homelessness receive HUD vouchers plus VA case management through their local VA medical centers. A HUD census counted 32,882 veterans who were homeless on a single night in January 2024. But GAO investigators found that VA staff did not consistently refer eligible veterans to the Housing Voucher Program. During 2020-2024, 174,000 eligible veterans were not referred, and VA didn't document the reason why for most of them, 87%, the report said. Having such data can help help VA fix problems that keep people out of the program, such as not having enough VA case managers to support program participants, the GAO found. In fiscal 2024, more than one quarter of medical centers with two or more case managers had at least 20% of these positions unfilled, the GAO audit found. Staff burnout and turnover contributed to vacancies, according to the report. The VA has taken steps to improve case manager hiring, but has not always collected data on the reasons that veterans were kept from entering the program. With more complete data on the reasons, VA could better assess its unmet need, adjust hiring strategies, and allocate case managers accordingly, the report found. VA then would be better positioned to serve more veterans. The GAO said it conducted the audit because lawmakers have cited barriers, including high costs to permanent housing for some veterans. The Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2023 included a provision for GAO to review VA case management and the availability of affordable housing for veterans experiencing homelessness. And that's Watchdog finds staff turnover, vacancies affect housing voucher program for homeless veterans. Next from Stripes.com, we have We Can Never Do Enough. Gary Sinise and Vietnam veterans in D.C. to celebrate National Vietnam War Veterans Day. This is by Matthew Adams from the 27th of March, Washington. Jim Taylor is looking forward to seeing some of his Vietnam band of brothers again after they took a two-week trip in November and visited the country for the first time since the war. Just get a big hug from each of them, because from the day we met and as we moved forward on that trip, we became family, he said. Taylor, 88, who lives northeast of Sacramento, California, is in Washington to celebrate National Vietnam War Veterans Day on Sunday. Vietnam Veterans Day was first proclaimed on March 29, 2012, by President Barack Obama, who called upon all Americans to observe the day with programs, ceremonies, and activities commemorating the 50-year anniversary of the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War Veterans Recognition Act of 2017 was signed into law by President Donald J. Trump, designating every March 29th as National Vietnam War Veterans Day. March 29, 1973 is the day the U.S. Military Assistance Command, Vietnam, was disestablished and the last American combat troops came home. Taylor, who retired as an Army major in 1980, joined the service from San Francisco in 1956. He served the first 10 years of his career as an enlisted soldier and attained the rank of staff sergeant before becoming a commissioned officer. In 1968, he received the Medal of Honor from President Lyndon Johnson and was promoted to captain for his actions in a battle west of Khe Sanh in November 1967. The former soldier said he had had previous opportunities to go back to Vietnam, but wasn't ready. He wasn't sure about returning because it didn't feel right. Veterans United Home Loans, the largest veterans affairs lender in the country, reached out to Taylor and others about returning to Vietnam. The group is working on producing a documentary about the 10 veterans and their trip. Taylor said the group started in the south near Ho Chi Minh City, also known as Saigon, and worked the way north to Hanoi. They visited his battle site later in the trip. "I wasn't on that battlefield alone. I had some great, great troopers with me, with a cavalry outfit," Taylor said. By November 8, 1967, Taylor was serving as a first lieutenant in Troop B, 1st Squadron, 1st Armored Cavalry Regiment, Americal Division in Vietnam. When he returned to the site, there was a moment when he stood looking over the rice paddies in the mountains where they would have engaged in a 10-hour battle. Taylor said it was mostly the same. He thought about Captain John Baravetto, Staff Sergeant David Wainscott, Specialist Thomas Lee Scott, PFC Jerry Wayne Gentry, the youngest of the group, and PFC Robert Nitz. All of their names are listed on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial on the National Mall, which recognizes more than 58,000 Americans who died or are missing in action. "It gave me some relief," Taylor said. "I closed my eyes and I said, 'Jerry, Robert, Thomas, and David and John, I'm just here to say I'm with you, brother, and I love you, and rest in peace. I'll never forget you and I'll never forsake you. You will always be part of my life.'" Veterans United is hosting a large-scale celebration in the nation's capital Sunday during cherry blossom season. The afternoon will include a ceremonial welcome walk and a concert on the National Mall featuring Gary Sinise and the Lieutenant Dan Band. Actor and comedian Rob Riggle, a retired Marine Corps Reserve officer, will serve as a master of ceremonies. Country music artist and Army reservist Craig Morgan will also perform. Sinise, an award-winning actor, is no stranger to being involved with Vietnam veterans and the military. Since 2003, Sinise and the band have performed more than 600 free concerts in support of active duty military, veterans, and first responders, according to the Gary Sinise Foundation. Sunday's event, though, will mark the first time he and his band will perform as part of the National Vietnam War Veterans Day in Washington. "I'm saying to you and your families, come on out. It's a free concert. Let us celebrate you. Let us welcome you home and give you a salute," Sinise said Wednesday. "We can never do enough to honor our veterans and support our defenders and their families." Sinise was a senior in high school in 1973 as the war wound down. A few years afterward, when he met his wife-to-be, she introduced him to her brothers who served in the war. "I started feeling very guilty over how kind of oblivious I was in high school to what guys and gals just a little bit older than I was were going through at that time. So I wanted to do something to support them," Sinise said. He started to support Vietnam veterans in the 1980s through the Chicago Theater Company he co-founded, the Steppenwolf, and became involved in local veterans groups. One of Sinise's best-known roles is his Oscar-nominated performance as Army Lieutenant Dan Taylor, a platoon leader who loses his legs fighting in Vietnam in 1994's Forrest Gump. "I'm glad I made the most out of the lessons I learned," Sinise said. Taylor and four of his new brothers are in Washington to celebrate Vietnam Veterans Day and partake in the festivities. The celebration comes as the U.S. approaches a month of combat operations against Iran. The White House says it's engaged in talks to end the joint U.S.-Israeli operation, which has resulted in the deaths of 13 U.S. troops and killed more than 2,400 people in Iran and Lebanon, according to those government's figures. The Pentagon is considering sending up to 10,000 more ground troops to the Middle East to potentially support operations in Iran, in a move aimed at giving President Donald Trump more military options, the Wall Street Journal reported Thursday. Taylor said people should say thank you on Vietnam Veterans Day, but that should be said to all veterans. He also added that people should have faith in their country. "If you want to support the troops, the president, or the veterans, get behind our country and support our country because we are the greatest country on earth," the retired major said. He encouraged people coming out this weekend to come to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial and say hello and look at those names that are on that wall. Say a silent prayer for each one of them and their family. And that's We Can Never Do Enough. Gary Sinise and the Vietnam Veterans in D.C. to celebrate National Vietnam War Veterans Day. And speaking of the Vietnam War, we turn to militarytimes.com for this item, The March of Folly. Americans' headlong lurch into Vietnam began with just 3,500 Marines. This is from the 30th of March by Claire Barrett. On March 8th, 1965, 3,500 Marines of the 9th Marine Expeditionary Brigade, the first combat troops in Vietnam, waded ashore to the coastal city of Da Nang. Unlike their forefathers, who were met with lethal sprays of machine guns and shells on the shores of the Pacific and Europe during World War II, these Marines were almost comically met by the mayor of Da Nang, with girls placing wreaths around the Marines' necks. Four American soldiers met them with a large sign stating, "Welcome, gallant Marines." Garlanded like ancient heroes, they then marched off to seize Hill 327, which turned out to be occupied only by rock apes, gorillas instead of gorillas, as the joke went, who did not contest the intrusion of their upright and heavily armed cousins, writes the Council on Foreign Relations. While the U.S. had been involved in Vietnam for over a decade, with the U.S. Military Assistance Advisory Group existing in Vietnam as early as 1950, the arrival of the 9th Marine Expeditionary Brigade historically marks the Americanization of the Vietnam War. Many in the upper echelons of American policymaking welcomed the landings. However, Maxwell Taylor, the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam at the time, and a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, expressed strong reservations. He predicted that it would be difficult to hold the line on further force commitments. His fears would prove accurate. By the end of 1965, 185,000 U.S. troops were in Vietnam. Less than 3 years later, the city that welcomed the Americans with handshakes and lays had become the host to high-level U.S. and South Vietnamese operations, including the headquarters of I Corps, the military zone encompassing South Vietnam's northern provinces. March of Folly. From the moment he was sworn into the presidency on November 22, 1963, Lyndon B. Johnson was hardened to the notion that he was not going to be the first American president to lose a war, according to the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Barbara Tuchman in her book, The March of Folly. Johnson's idea was to fight and negotiate simultaneously, she wrote. The difficulty was that the limited war aim was unachievable by limited war. The North had no intention of ever conceding a non-communist South, and since such a concession could have been forced upon them only by military victory, and since such a victory was unattainable by the U.S. short of total war and invasion, which it was unwilling to undertake, the American war aim was therefore foreclosed. If this was recognized by some, it was not acted upon because no one was prepared to admit American failure. Activists could believe the bombing might succeed. Doubters would vaguely hope some solution would turn up. As Johnson chose to fight and negotiate simultaneously, Operation Rolling Thunder began in earnest. The soon-to-be, frequently interrupted bombing campaign had just begun prior to the sustained American ground campaign. The operation, which began on February 24, 1965, had initially begun as a diplomatic signal to impress the North Vietnamese of America's determination and serve as a warning that the violence would continue to escalate unless Ho Chi Minh blinked. According to the Air Force Historical Division, General Curtis LeMay argued that military targets rather than the enemy's resolve should be attacked and that the blow should be rapid and sharp. When that outcome failed to arise after the first several weeks in March 1965, the purpose of the campaign began to change. Throughout the next decade, more than 2.6 million U.S. servicemen and women eventually rotated through Vietnam. More than 58,000 of them died there, according to the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, with President Donald Trump weighing his next steps in the war against Iran and thousands of soldiers from the U.S. Army's elite 82nd Airborne Division arriving in the Middle East, certain parallels have begun to emerge between the opening days of the war with Vietnam and Iran. Operation Epic Fury. Since Operation Epic Fury, a joint undertaking by the U.S. and Israeli militaries against the Islamic Republic that began on February 28, over 11,000 targets have been struck. Targetry never makes up for a lack of strategy, General Jim Mattis, who served as Trump's first defense secretary, cautioned in a recent interview. By that I mean 15,000 targets have been hit. There have been significant military successes, but they're not matched by strategic outcomes. Now, according to the Washington Post, the Pentagon is putting together plans for weeks of ground operations in Iran as U.S. forces amass in the region. Citing multiple U.S. officials, the Post report suggested ground operations could involve both conventional infantry and special operations elements, but would not yet rise to the level of a full-scale invasion. It's the job of the Pentagon to make preparations in order to give the commander, its chief, maximum optionality, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said in a statement provided to Military Times. Does not mean the president has made a decision. The Post report comes as U.S. military assets continue to flood the region. On Friday, U.S. Marines and sailors assigned to the Tripoli Amphibious Ready Group arrived in U.S. Central Command waters. The Pentagon has also confirmed elements from the 82nd Airborne Division headquarters and a brigade combat team are deploying to the Middle East. Based out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the 82nd acts as the Army's rapid response force and is often among the first units sent to respond to emerging crises. The report also comes on the heels of an Iranian missile and drone attack on Friday that injured a dozen U.S. service members at Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia. Two of the 12 injuries are considered to be serious. 13 service members have been killed in action and nearly 300 wounded during Operation Epic Fury, a joint undertaking by U.S. and Israeli militaries against the Islamic Republic that began on February 28th. The majority of the wounded have since returned to duty, according to U.S. Central Command. John Simpkins contributed to this report, "The March of Folly, America's headlong lurch into Vietnam, began with just 3,500 Marines." Turn now to the Nationals honor baseball players turned citizen soldiers in Arlington Tribute. This from MilitaryTimes.com by Claire Barrett from the 27th of March. The cherry blossoms are in bloom. Glints of hope are still fresh in fans' eyes. Beer is flowing. Hot dogs are being consumed at alarming rates. It's baseball time. But amid the festivities is a tradition now in its third year that intersects America's favorite pastime and military service. Ahead of opening day, Arlington National Cemetery placed official Major League Baseball's, courtesy of the Nationals, on the gravesites of six men, all former baseball players turned citizen soldiers. The baseballs were placed at the gravesites of Lucerne Lou Blue. Blue, a D.C. native who rose to prominence under Ty Cobb's Detroit Tigers. The first baseman had his career briefly interrupted in 1918 when he was drafted into the U.S. Army, serving at Camp Lee in Virginia until war's end. Abner Doubleday. This Union general was among those who defended Fort Sumter during the 1861 bombardment, rose to fame for his gallantry at Gettysburg, and supposedly invented baseball, writes Colleen Cheslack Poulton for the American Battlefield Trust. While the claim is pure fabrication, it does make for an entertaining tale. William Eckert, Lieutenant General Eckert, who at the time of his commission was the youngest three-star in the United States Armed Forces, became baseball's commissioner following the recommendation of General Curtis, bombs away, LeMay. Elmer Gideon. Gideon was a player for the Washington Senators before his time in the league was cut short when he was drafted in 1941. Gideon was shot down and killed on a mission over France in 1944. He and Harry O'Neill are the only two Major League Baseball players to have been killed during World War II. Spotswood Spot Poles. Poles, a Negro League's outfielder known for his speed and batting average, think 487, served in the 369th Infantry Regiment, also known as the Harlem Hellfighters, one of the most renowned black combat units of World War I. The all-black unit would go on to spend 191 days in continuous combat, more than any other American unit of its size. During that time, about 1,400 soldiers were killed or wounded, suffering more losses than any other American regiment during the war. In his own right, Poles earned 5 battle stars and a Purple Heart for his heroism. Ernest Judson Judd Wilson. Wilson, who grew up in Foggy Bottom, D.C., played for the Negro League's Homestead Grays in D.C. between 1931 and 32 and 1940 and 45. The third baseman served in World War I as a corporal in Company D, 417th Service Battalion, and was posthumously inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 2006. He is a member of the Ring of Honor at Nationals Park. And that's the Nationals Honor Baseball Players Turned Citizen Soldiers in Arlington Tribute. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. And you can get that for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. We'll turn now to one of our Veteran Service Organization publications, Military Officer, and that's a magazine of Military Officers Association of America. From April, Mission Advocacy, we have a fix for inaccurate TRICARE claims. An error charged some beneficiaries 2 copays for 1 visit. Military families might soon see some of their TRICARE claims reprocessed to correct an error that charged beneficiaries 2 copays for the same medical appointment. The fix would eliminate the patient responsibility for a network facility fee copay in addition to the copay for an outpatient office visit. After the transition to a new TRICARE claims processor on January 1, 2025, some beneficiaries were mistakenly charged both copays. Thanks to beneficiaries who shared their explanation of benefits, their EOB documents, with MOA, we were able to verify this claims processing issue and escalate it to the TRICARE contractors for resolution. Inaccurate claims are being reprocessed to reflect $0 patient responsibility for the network facility fee in conjunction with a network outpatient visit. Hospitals are allowed to charge patients a facility fee on top of the charges for medical services to help cover the high cost of running a hospital. Patients sometimes encounter facility fees when they receive outpatient care from a provider, office attached to a hospital, or medical center. As hospitals buy up physician practices, urgent care centers, walk-in clinics, and standalone surgery centers, patients are more likely to encounter a facility fee even when they receive care outside the hospital setting. The TRICARE copay construct, which was implemented in January 2018, rolled facility fees into the copay calculation for network outpatient visits. When a beneficiary has an outpatient visit and both the provider and facility are in network, the patient is responsible for only one copay for the office visit. There should be no copay for the facility fee. Families with recurring medical appointments noticed the change. For specialty visits that include facility fees, Group A retiree families on TRICARE Select saw their out-of-pocket costs increase from $51 per visit to $102 with the addition of the facility fee copay. Impacted claims are being reprocessed, and beneficiaries should expect to receive new EOB documents for those visits that indicate $0 patient responsibility for the facility fee charge. Notably, if the provider is non-network or the facility is non-network, the patient is responsible for a copay for the network portion of the visit and a percentage-based cost share for the non-network portion of the visit. Once TRICARE reprocesses claims, medical provider billing offices may proactively apply an account credit or send a refund if the patient already paid the mistaken facility fee copay. Alternatively, impacted patients can contact the provider's billing office to request a refund. Be sure to provide a copy of the revised EOB that shows the $0 patient responsibility for the facility fee. This article was by Karen Rudisuli, and that's MOA's Director of Government Relations for Health Affairs. The article, A Fix for Inaccurate TRICARE Claims. Well, let's turn to the Veterans Administration and specifically the Phoenix VA Healthcare System for their newsletter, Veterans News Now. And their first announcement, enhancing the veteran experience with innovations that support focused, efficient care. The Phoenix VA Healthcare System is introducing Ambient Artificial Intelligence, or AI Scribe, starting with primary care visits, with plans for future expansion to all clinical appointments across the Phoenix VA Healthcare System. Ambient AI Scribe is a new, secure tool that helps your provider capture clinical notes during your visit, allowing them to focus more on you and less on the keyboard. Veterans can expect more one-on-one time with your provider, the same high-quality VA care centered on what matters most, your health. Your privacy is always protected and participation is completely optional. You can opt out at any time without any impact on the quality of your care or your VA benefits. We're committed to bringing innovative solutions to healthcare because our veterans deserve the very best. You can learn more by going to youtube.com and watching their video, Understanding Ambient Scribe AI Technology at VA. That's kind of a long link, so I would just suggest going to youtube.com and searching for Ambient Scribe AI. Discover the power of smart snacking and stay nourished on any budget. If you want to learn cooking and meal prepping skills, check out the resources available through VA. they have a Healthy Teaching Kitchen YouTube channel. And again, you can go to youtube.com/playlist? And search for the Healthy Teaching Kitchen, and it should pop up for you. There's also a Fresh Focus podcast, and that's available at freshfocus.transistor, transistor.fm/episodes. And for recipes and cookbooks, you can go to www.nutrition.va.gov/recipes.asp. They invite you to talk with your registered dietitian nutritionist for more resources. And you can call 602-277-5551, then press 2 and then press 4 to schedule an appointment. Then we have the Sustainability Fair 2026, and this will be on Thursday, April the 16th, 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. And it'll be at the Phoenix VA Medical Center, the main hallway of the ACC. You can contact the GEMS program manager for more information. That's at 602-277-5551, and that extension 5262. Celebrate the Month of Military Child, and that will be on April 18th, 2026. That's a Saturday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. The Grind Cafe, and that's at 13802 North Vermina Street, and that's in El Mirage. Inviting all community families, military and veteran kids, civilian kids, come and celebrate today together, a fun day for everyone. The free activities include game booths, raffles with prizes, delicious snacks and refreshments, and you can wear purple to show support. What is the Month of Military Child? April is designated to honor the unique contributions and sacrifices of children in military families. It honors their resilience and adaptability. There are over 1.6 million military-connected youth. It's represented by the dandelion. It blooms wherever the wind carries it. Strength in every story. This is sponsored by CNJ Resource, and for more info, you can email CN Johnson, that's one word, cnjohnson365@yahoo.com. In the VA News and Information, Vet Resources, a weekly newsletter for veterans. Vet Resources, a weekly newsletter for veterans, their families, caregivers, and survivors. And you can sign up at www.va.gov/VetResources, and that's one word, VetResources. You can sign up for a number of newsletters on www.va.gov. That's where I get a lot of the information for the announcements that I read here on Weekly Reveille. Then we have VA Health and Benefits App adds new Certificate of Eligibility enhancements. For veterans, the journey to home ownership often begins with one essential document, the Certificate of Eligibility. This certificate verifies eligibility for VA home loan benefits, making home buying more affordable and achievable for eligible veterans, service members, and surviving spouses. With the latest update to the VA Health and Benefits mobile app, viewing the latest certificate of eligibility has never been more convenient. And if you go to, again, www.va.gov/housing-assistance, you'll see a menu on the left side of the webpage, and it will tell you how to request a certificate of eligibility, how to request it online, and where to download the app. And then finally, we'll end with Phoenix VA important phone numbers. For all emergency department visits, call the VA 72-hour notification hotline within 72 hours of presenting to a non-VA community ER. A VA 72-hour notification hotline, you can call 844-724-7842. The emergency room or pharmacy reimbursement, call the VA Community Care Contact Center, and that's at 877-881-7618. The urgent care bill number is 800-698-2411. For a community care bill, you can call 877-226-8749. For an ambulance bill, call Benny Travel, and that's at 602-277-5551, and their extension 7903. For the VA copay bill, call WCPAC at 888-827-4817. If you're unable to travel to the Phoenix VA Healthcare System Veteran Resource Center, or if you're unsure who to call, call C4, and that's 877-881-7618. And the Veterans Crisis Line is at 800-273-8255, and press 1 for confidential help for veterans and their family. You can also follow the Phoenix VA Healthcare System on their official social media, and that's available on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube. And that is the Phoenix Area VA Healthcare System newsletter, Veterans News Now. Our next item is from news.va.gov, and it's Civil War Nurses Who Demanded to Be Remembered. This is from the 31st of March by James Pernol, Public Affairs Specialist of the VHA Office of Communications. The women who served, sacrificed, and fought for recognition. In May 1861, as the Civil War began and the nation fractured, Georgiana Woolsey walked into New York Hospital with no formal medical training, only resolve. The wounded were already arriving. Infection spread faster than knowledge. Supplies were thin, and yet, like thousands of other women, Woolsey stepped forward. Early service, sacrifice, and resilience. Patriotism, she later reflected, was not an abstraction. It was hands in bandages, hours at the bedside, and the willingness to witness suffering most Americans would never see. Standards, expectations, and the worth of Dorothea Dix. More than 6,000 women served as nurses for the Union during the Civil War. About half were appointed through the office of Dorothea L. Dix, who in June 1861 was named Superintendent of Army Nurses. Dix imposed strict standards, requiring nurses to be plain in dress, mature, and disciplined, in part to ensure they'd be taken seriously in male-dominated military hospitals. These women, Dix insisted, must be matrons of experience, good conduct, or superior education. Respectability was armor in a skeptical world. Others volunteered through relief organizations like the U.S. Sanitary Commission or worked directly in military hospitals. They staffed city infirmaries, served aboard hospital ships, and worked shockingly close to battle lines. They changed dressings, stiff with blood, spoon-fed soldiers too weak to lift their heads, and wrote letters home for men who would never return. The work was grueling. Disease, typhoid, dysentery, pneumonia claimed more lives than bullets. Yet the nurses persisted. As one contemporary observer put it, they labored with a fortitude that would have honored the bravest soldier in the field. Labor, loss, and the realities of wartime nursing. And still, when the war ended, their service did not translate into security. Unlike male veterans, Civil War nurses were not granted automatic pensions or access to federal veterans benefits. They were not formally recognized as soldiers. Many were excluded from influential veterans organizations such as the Grand Army of the Republic. Their wartime patriotism did not shield them from peacetime neglect. The women organized. Groups such as the Ex-Nurses Association of the District of Columbia and the Women's Relief Corps began advocating for recognition and financial assistance. They provided aid to former nurses who'd fallen into poverty and pressed Congress to acknowledge what they'd given. Their argument was simple and direct. Service is service. After years of lobbying, Congress passed legislation in 1892 granting a modest monthly pension to women who'd served at least 6 months as Civil War nurses. It was not parity, but it was recognition. For the first time, the federal government formally affirmed that these women's labor in wartime hospitals constituted national service worthy of compensation. The victory was both symbolic and practical. It validated decades of quiet endurance and established a precedent that would shape future debates about women in military roles. Their legacy and the meaning of service. Looking back, the story of Civil War nurses is not solely about battlefield medicine. It's about citizenship. It's about who counts when a nation tallies sacrifice. And it is about women who, without rank or formal commission, stood at the center of America's bloodiest conflict and refused to be erased from its memory. Their legacy echoes in every expansion of veterans' benefits that followed. Before there were formal nurse corps, before women held commissions, before comprehensive veterans' health systems existed, there were women, like Woolsey, answering a nation's call and later insisting that the nation answer theirs. As we reflect on Women's History Month, it's vital to acknowledge not just the institutional history of veteran care, but the women whose compassion, leadership, and advocacy shaped it at every level. And that's the Civil War nurses who demanded to be remembered. Our next item from news.va.gov, Navy veteran finds convenience with VA virtual care. This is from the 1st of April by Gwen McMillan. She's a communications specialist at the Digital Health Office. Virtual care resources save veterans time. When it comes to managing his health care, Navy veteran Eric Faulkner wants it to be as convenient as possible. That's why he uses VA's virtual care resources. For appointments that don't require an in-person visit, including some of his primary care and dermatology appointments, Faulkner opts to take them through VA Video Connect. That, by the way, is available at mobile.va.gov/app/va-video-connect. VA's secure video conferencing app from the comfort of his own home. Video appointments are always good when you don't have serious or emergency health concerns, said Faulkner, who served in the Navy for 27 years, including as an independent duty corpsman. One of the things that telehealth will save you is a drive time, Faulkner said. Does save time, does save you money. Anytime you're not using gas, guess what you're doing? You're saving money while resolving your health concerns. The ease of virtual care. Along with his virtual appointments, Faulkner also regularly uses My Health eVet on va.gov, VA's healthcare portal, to manage his healthcare. My Health eVet, that's my go-to right there. I use My Health eVet to resolve a lot of my healthcare concerns, Faulkner said. Faulkner, who lives an hour away from the nearest VA medical center and more than 30 minutes from the nearest community-based outpatient clinic, regularly uses the healthcare portal to request and refill VA prescriptions, review his lab results, and communicate with his VA care team through secure messaging for non-urgent issues. It saves from driving to an appointment, and it also provides me quick access to my care team, he said. And if they're unable to resolve the issue, they'll move it on to the provider. Championing telehealth for others. For veterans who may not have tried VA's virtual care resources yet, Faulkner's advice is simple. Just try it. Take time to utilize all the tools. I'm sure you will like it. Use it to your advantage, he added. Saves time on the road and also gets things resolved. For more information about telehealth services available to veterans, you can visit VA Telehealth Services, and that's at telehealth, TELEHEALTH dot VA dot gov. And that's Navy Veteran Finds Convenience with VA Virtual Care. And again, you can go to news.va.gov and search for health on their website and get these links in an easy, clickable form rather than having to type them in. And speaking of My Health eVet, we have this item from the My Health eVet website, and that's at www.myhealth.va.gov. The article is Get Back to Sleep. VA's Insomnia Coach app can help. If you struggle with sleep, you're not alone. Many veterans live with insomnia. Insomnia is when you can't fall asleep or stay asleep. You may have insomnia for a few nights in a row from time to time, or your sleep trouble may be ongoing. No matter how often you struggle to get good sleep, the Insomnia Coach app can help. And you can get the Insomnia Coach on the VA mobile app website. And that's available at mobile.va.gov/app/insomnia-coach. How to use the Insomnia Coach. Insomnia Coach was created for everyone. It's easy to use. It can be used as a standalone education and self-care tool or as an addition to professional care. This app is based on scientific research about how people can change their behaviors and thoughts to improve sleep. Insomnia Coach provides new users with a 5-week training plan. Each morning, you'll take a couple of minutes to log your sleep from the night before. Then you'll receive personalized feedback to help you sleep better. The tools in the app can be used at any time when you want to stay awake, relax before bed, or get back to sleep in the middle of the night. Once you complete the training plan, you can keep using the app to maintain good sleep habits. How Insomnia Coach helps. With Insomnia Coach, you can decide what tools work best to develop a personalized sleep plan. Main features include guided weekly training plan to help you track and improve your sleep, sleep coach with tips and personal feedback about your sleep, an interactive sleep diary to help you track daily changes, and tools to help you relax and prepare for sleep. What else can I do? If you have trouble sleeping, talk to your healthcare team at your next appointment or use My Health eVet to reach out with a secure message. They may ask you to do a sleep diary like the one available on the Insomnia Coach app or a sleep study to help diagnose your symptoms. And you can share the results at your next appointment. You can learn more about messages on My Health eVet. Is there a version of the app available online? Insomnia Coach is only available for mobile devices. However, Path to Better Sleep is a free online course based on cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. It has a different format than Insomnia Coach, but many tools and tips are included. You can learn more about Path to Better Sleep on the Veteran Training website, and that's at www.veterantraining, one word, veterantraining.va.gov/insomnia. You can manage your health care with the new My Health eVet experience. The new My Health eVet experience on va.gov allows you to manage your health care needs in the same place that you manage your other VA benefits and services. You can manage appointments, refill prescriptions, find your medical records, and more. You can also send a secure message to your healthcare team all in one place. You can manage your health care with My Health eVet on www.va.gov, and that's at www.va.gov/health-care/manage-health. And that's Get Back to Sleep from the My Health eVet website. Our final item, find the PTSD treatment that's right for you. This is from the 29th of March by Sadie Larson, PhD, psychologist at the National Center for PTSD. The PTSD Treatment Decision Aid helps you find the right path. Post-traumatic stress disorder looks different for everyone. That's why it's so important to talk to your clinician and find the treatment that's right for you. The PTSD Treatment Decision Aid helps you learn about treatment options, compare the ones you like, and then use when you feel ready to talk about them with a mental health care clinician. If you just learned you have PTSD or have tried treatment before and want a new option, the PTSD TDA can help. The tool makes it easy for you to explore your options anytime, anywhere. What is the PTSD Treatment Decision Aid? There are many proven treatments for PTSD, including therapies and medications. The Treatment Decision Aid is an interactive tool that can help you explore these options and choose what works best for you. The Treatment Decision Aid was created by VA's National Center for PTSD to help you learn about PTSD and its treatments. You can also watch videos that explain your treatment options and find answers to questions about PTSD and treatment. This can help you feel more ready and involved in choosing your treatment. You can explore information about PTSD and PTSD treatments. The Treatment Decision Aid shares information on PTSD treatments like trauma-focused talk therapies and medications. You can find answers to questions about treatment and watch videos on different topics. This includes stories from fellow veterans and videos of clinicians explaining different treatments. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time for this week's weekly Reveille and find the PTSD treatment that's right for you. But again, you can go to news.va.gov and search for health and PTSD and find this article and the links for the treatment decision aid. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this week's weekly Reveille. And remind you, you can listen to weekly Reveille streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show, or you can listen to individual programs or the Sun Sounds of Arizona stream, both on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available for your iPhone and iPad from the Apple App Store or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store.